Please rise. The Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Ross, Judge Rodenberg, Judge Jessen, the Honorable Kevin G. Ross presiding.
Good morning. And please be seated. Welcome to the Court of Appeals for this October 16 panel. We have six cases on our calendar today. Four are by oral argument. Two of those are by interactive television, and then we have two non-oral cases. The first matter on our oral calendar this morning is, I'm going to see if I can pronounce it, is it Botang?
Yes, Your Honor.
Botang v. State of Minnesota. Counsel, each of you will have 15 minutes to present your argument with an additional 5 minutes to appellant's counsel if you choose to use that time for rebuttal. We did send a framing of an issue to parties in anticipation of the argument today, and I hope the parties will incorporate into their oral argument a response to this court's concern about a potential jurisdictional issue in the district court. With that, appellant's counsel, whenever you're ready to proceed, you have the floor.
Thank you, Your Honor. My name is Stephen Grigsby. I'm arguing on behalf of Mr. Botang. Let me begin exactly squarely with the jurisdictional issue the court raised. So, received it Monday, and when I looked at it, I immediately looked at the post-conviction statute, and as a literal construction of the statute, it says post-conviction's available only to a person convicted of a crime. This court's jurisprudence has been perfectly clear that a stay of adjudication is not the conviction of a crime, and it seemed to end the analysis, but I think there's a lot more to it than that, and I'd like to address what I think are four substantial ways in which the subject matter jurisdiction issue is really, while understandable, is not dispositive in this issue. First, the issue here is not with the definition of a conviction at the state level court. The entire implication of constitutional rights involves the definition of a conviction that applies to federal immigration law that was raised in the submissions by Mr. Botang to the district court. So in essence, a Mr. Botang with a stay of adjudication is somebody who is convicted for purposes of the federal deportation rules, which implicate the specific constitutional right that is filled out in Padilla.
So how would one get post conviction, how would the district court be able to make a decision that would affect the conviction in federal court under the state post-conviction statute?
By regarding the term conviction with at least one narrow exception carved into it, that for state convictions, post-conviction relief is not available.
Does the record indicate that Mr. Botang was convicted in a federal proceeding, even if your theory applies?
The record does show that under federal law, which is the law that implicates his right that he raised in the post-conviction petition, that is clear that the federal government.
My question is, you said that the post-conviction proceeding might be incorporated in this case as a conviction because there was a federal conviction. I thought that was your argument.
No, there was a conviction for federal purposes, but not a conviction for state purposes.
Federal law regards this as a conviction, whether it is or not.
Well, that's the question. There's no universal definition of what a conviction is. You have to go to the various jurisdictions. They defined it in various different ways. In the federal system that implicates the constitutional right here, it is a conviction for those purposes. It's just under a very narrow reading of Minnesota statutory interpretation and case law that's not a conviction.
What is your understanding as to whether the statute itself suggests that the Minnesota statute contemplates treatment of a Minnesota case as a conviction, even if in Minnesota it's not a conviction?
Well, because the statute indicates, although it makes it available for a person only after conviction, That conviction is never defined within the post-conviction statute itself. So what essentially this court has done with its various jurisprudence has gone to other decisions defining conviction, but in none of those cases was conviction defined in a way that would address the constitutional issue raised by Mr. Boateng. And the other part of the post-conviction statute, if you look at subdivision 2, it says that this is a statutory remedy that abolishes all previous statutory remedy, common law remedies, unless it's inadequate to challenge the validity of a conviction or a sentence or other disposition. So even within 590.01, it does refer, it says conviction, but also refers to disposition too. There would be no need to talk about disposition if it was limited to convictions. But I think here is really the very serious problem with the jurisprudence that has interpreted the post-conviction statute so narrowly. It's perfectly clear that even on a stay of adjudication, a person can suffer consequences. And basically, when the constitutionally defective remedy is ineffective assistance of counsel, now you have an entire class of people who could receive ineffective assistance of counsel, be denied the constitutional right, and also be denied any state court remedy to address a constitutional violation.
So that seems to be an argument that Lozner is wrong.
Well, it is potentially an argument that Lozner is wrong because I think it defines conviction too narrowly, but also it's wrong in the sense that you don't need to rewrite the statute. You can have a construction of conviction on the issues raised before the court, because under in Lozner, this was not ineffective assistance of counsel post Padilla. This was something that involves a completely different set of issues. But let me also say this, is that
the argument there was also collateral consequences. It's not Padilla consequences, but it's consequences of some significance.
If this was a collateral consequence, I'd say the court's right. This is not a collateral consequence. This is a constitutional violation, and the term collateral consequences is not equatable to what was at stake in an enhanceable provision in Lozner.
Well, it's a collateral constitutional consequence. I mean, it's collateral to the case. I mean, I think the principle seems to, I don't see how that principle is really any different from the issue that was addressed in Lozner.
Well, I'll tell you exactly how I think it is that in Lozner, the collateral consequence is part of all those collateral consequences that never implicated ineffective assistance of counsel. Since Padilla, there is one collateral consequence, call it what you may, but when that consequence is deportation, it involves a constitutional right. There is no other class of collateral consequences that have been as articulated and set forth as clearly as deportation. The other way I think the court can handle this is very simply is to treat the pleadings in this matter raised by Mr. Boateng not so much as post-conviction relief, but construe the pleadings to really be what he initially filed in that court as a motion to withdraw the plea. Oddly, he filed a motion to withdraw the plea. The state joined in that motion to withdraw the plea. And despite the agreement of the parties to withdraw the plea, the court denied it, and then in its order denying it, invited Mr. Boateng to file a post-conviction petition, which he did. We had a hearing, and then the court ultimately denied that.
So it never actually ruled on the motion to withdraw the plea, or it did.
It denied that was the appropriate mechanism to seek the relief that he wanted, which is to withdraw the plea. The court believed that manifest injustice, ineffective assistance of counsel, couldn't be raised under the standard of a motion to withdraw the plea. I think it clearly can, and I think that if this court treats the post-conviction petition in essence as a motion to withdraw the plea, you also solve the problem of the statutory construction of conviction under the post-conviction petition, because in essence that was the issue. The other thing is the parties would be the same, the issues, the facts are the same, and the legal analysis and standard are all identical between these two narrow class of cases, this type of post-conviction and the motion to withdraw the plea. And the court can do that just like it does in multiple cases where it liberally construes the pleadings to get to the substance and to render justice. The third point I wish to make is that there also is the avenue of discretionary review. If you look at the jurisprudence the case cited in its order in this case asking us to discuss jurisdiction, you find that there are, it relies on Smith. Luntzer essentially repeats what Smith says, and in Smith, there were two reasons not to apply discretionary review, which I think are distinguishable from the reasons in this case. One is that she had not filed an appeal within 30 days from the denial of the post-conviction petition. In this case, petitioner Mr. Boateng did. Secondly, is that it was argued that she consented to the stay of adjudication. And because she consented to it, and that consent was never invalidated, she did not warrant discretionary review. Well, in this case, when the issue is ineffective assistance of counsel for not advising somebody of a collateral consequence that has constitutionally important dimensions, one cannot say Mr. Boateng, in fact, consented. Because if anything, ineffective assistance counsel invalidates the knowing, voluntary, and intelligent qualities that are necessary to have that to have a plea.
Can I turn your attention to the merits of your appeal?
Sure.
Leaving the jurisdictional question aside, let's assume that you're right on the jurisdictional question, and let's assume you're also correct on the issue of effectiveness of counsel. The counsel was ineffective in failing to identify a clear law and to advise your client of it. What record evidence is there that supports your client's allegation that he would not have pleaded guilty but for this, his attorney's failure? You had an opportunity, your client had an opportunity to have an evidentiary hearing and actually to present evidence on the matter of prejudice. What evidence is there of prejudice?
Well, I don't know if that exact question is in the transcript. It may or may not be, but I can say this, is that I think if you look at the way that Padilla discussed this, what we have is Padilla discusses the notion that deportation is oftentimes a much more serious consequence than even a jail sentence. And in this case, this was a misdemeanor. He would have pled to, and this would have automatically resulted in his deportation. And I think that the court can simply infer that no rational human being would have automatically consented to deportation to avoid the penalties that can be associated with the most serious misdemeanor, which is a 90-day maximum. He had no criminal record. He was certainly not facing that.
So I'm listening between the lines as to the implied answer to the question is that your client presented no evidence that he would have acted differently if properly advised, but you are saying we should infer that your client would have acted in a way consistent with to show prejudice.
Well, it's either on the record that he was asked that question and answered it that way, or it's not. In the latter case where the court, he hasn't been asked that question to give that answer, my suggestion is it's simply self-evident.
Well, you're still not quite answering the question. You're saying either it's on the record or it's not. I'm asking you, is it in the record?
I don't know that question in the record was asked. The transcript was speaking for itself.
Not a question. I'm asking if there's any evidence in the record that would indicate, that would constitute evidence presented to the district court that your client would have pleaded guilty but for his attorney's failure to provide the information.
Correct. And my answer is I don't recall the specifics of the transcript, but if it is in the transcript, it would be a question that I would have asked him and he would have answered in that way. In the assuming that it's not in the record, the argument is that Padilla essentially makes it self-evident that it is per se ineffective.
Is there a case that supports your per se prejudice?
I believe it's in the language in Padilla that is simply self-evident.
Are you aware of any case after Padilla in Minnesota or elsewhere in the country that has applied this per se prejudice rule that you're asking us to adopt?
No, I'm not aware of any other case. So if I can return to the jurisdictional issue, that I think that this court has to, in some way, provide under Section 1, Article 8 of the Minnesota Constitution, some meaningful remedy for a person in the court who is subject to a constitutional defect in the proceedings, a violation of his rights, to have some forum to come before the court. I think there's two ways to do it. One is to create an exception for conviction when the federal definition of conviction is what's driving the constitutionality of the violation, and or two, to equate this with essentially a motion to withdraw the plea. That's all I have. Thank you.
Thank you. You will have 5 minutes of additional time for rebuttal if you choose to use it. Counsel for the state.
May it please the court. My name is Todd Zettler. I represent Respondent, the state of Minnesota. I can tell the court clearly that there is nothing in the record, nowhere ever does he say he would not have pled guilty, not in any affidavit, and certainly not in the transcript at the hearing before the judge. There is zero evidence that he would not have pled guilty. His attorney, Matthew Mankey, said he had no defense to this case. A stay of adjudication was better than a full conviction. He was hoping for the best, but that's what happened.
So there is a per se, you've got a misdemeanor. Why would anybody plead guilty to a misdemeanor if the consequence is deportation, if one knows the consequence is deportation?
Well, there's no evidence that is the consequence here, Judge. I mean, that's what's stated, that he will, and I believe the statement was automatically resulted in deportation. That's not what he testified to, and he being Mr. Boateng. Mr. Boateng said he's a green card holder, and based on his internet research, he thinks that there might be adverse consequence sometime in the future.
Well, despite what he says, let's assume we read the statute as saying that he's immediately deportable, and that his attorney was ineffective in failing to advise him as such. Just for the purposes of this question, assume that that's so, and that there was ineffective assistance of counsel for failure to advise Mr. Boateng accordingly. Now get to the heart of my question.
I don't believe that there is any case law anywhere that says there's presumed automatic per se prejudice under those circumstances. A defendant has to say, I wouldn't have pled guilty, because they can plead guilty for all kinds of different reasons. And in this case, he negotiated a better deal than he would have otherwise gotten. He had no defense to the charge. He got a better criminal result than he
had. Right, that assumes no deportation, though. I mean, are you aware of any case that has actually addressed the question of whether the prejudice prong is necessary where you're facing only a minor offense?
In ineffective assistance of counsel, the prejudice prong is always necessary.
Do you agree with appellant's counsel that the state joined in the request to withdraw the plea to the district court?
My recollection is that the state did not object to it, did not oppose it, but didn't agree to it. And I also don't agree with the characterization that the district court invited a post-conviction petition. The district court properly said you can't do this by way of a motion. You can bring a post-conviction petition. That would be the proper form and way to try to do that. But that's different than saying, please bring one.
It does appear that the district court on August 13th of 18 did deny the motion to withdraw the plea.
Correct. And at that time stated, and in the order stated, you're giving me no legal basis to withdraw the plea. You're making an argument in equity.
Right, but this appeal is not from that denial.
Correct.
It was a denial, and we now have a post-conviction petition from which the appeal is taken, which returns us back to the original question of whether the district court had subject matter jurisdiction in the absence of a conviction.
And it does not. I mean, the court is, this is exactly under Lunzer in the cases that, frankly, I think five or six cases that follow Lunzer basically implying and imposing that same law, that from a stay of adjudication, especially when the case is already closed, that there is no subject matter jurisdiction.
How do you address Mr. Grigsby makes the point that, well, he's conceding there's no state conviction, but if the federal government treats the stay of adjudication as a conviction for the purposes of the state's immigration consequences, or the federal government's immigration consequences. And the term conviction is not defined, and Luzner doesn't address this issue. It wasn't in this circumstance. So why don't we treat this as a conviction for the purposes of a challenge in the post-conviction statute?
The Post-Conviction Remedy Act is a creature of the legislature. It's a statute, a Minnesota statute. So how Louisiana treats convictions, how Arizona treats convictions, how the feds treat convictions does not matter for how we interpret our statute and how this court has interpreted its statute in the published opinion. This court follows published opinions until there's a new rule of law.
Well, we've never had a case like this, have we, where the issue presented is that this is a conviction loosely defined by virtue of the effect of the stay of adjudication and the treatment of it as a conviction by federal government.
I'm not sure that I've ever seen this court interpret conviction in Minnesota by how some other jurisdiction interprets conviction. I'm not sure there's any authority for that at all.
Have we ever had the issue?
No, I can't recall a comparable situation, no.
Could you address Mr. Grigsby's argument that when we look at this, we also have to look in mind with the Minnesota Constitution, Section 1, Article 8, that there needs to be some meaningful remedy when he encourages us to equate this with a motion to withdraw the plea?
I mean, you would always have a direct appeal. That's your primary method of remedying wrongs that occur in the district court if there is a wrong. Then he could have directly appealed in this case, and he didn't, because he wanted the stay of adjudication that he negotiated. So unless the court has any questions, I would first, this is a subject matter barred case. Second, there is no prejudice. Third, there was no ineffective assistance because no standard was ever set that it was breached. Thank you.
Thank you. Councilor Pellant, you have 5 minutes of rebuttal.
Thank you. So I wanted to address the court's question about what in the record suggests that but for the ineffective assistance, he would have not pled guilty. Well, I direct you to page 27 of the transcript in this matter. And beginning on line 8, I think that between line 8 and 17, we have a recitation by his lawyer that, if you look at it, clearly implies that he was seeking to avoid the immigration consequence to withdraw the plea. It basically says that the lawyer is saying he sent him to an immigration lawyer, and he informed me that if this plea were withdrawn and he were to replead to a disorderly conduct, all the immigration consequences would go away. So that suggests right there that after the plea, he was aware of the fact that because of the immigration consequences, he would not have pled to it had he known them. And it's only for the ineffective assistance of counsel that he did that in the first place.
I'd like you to quote the language that you are referring to that you would say would lead us to the conclusion that the record includes evidence that your client would not have pleaded guilty but for the alleged ineffective.
Sure. Let me get on line 13. The lawyer says, I believe that. Well, not I believe. I know that Mr. Prokosh, who's the immigration lawyer, informed me that if this plea were withdrawn and he were to replead to a disorderly conduct, that all the immigration consequences would go away. And I don't think that...
What does that have to do with your client?
Because he's referring to... The lawyer is referring to Mr. Boateng trying to vacate the plea after having learned about the immigration consequences from the plea because he was not properly informed of them.
You're asking us to read an awful lot.
I don't think I am, because I suggest if you look at this, it clearly shows the defendant trying to vacate the plea. He's only doing that after he received ineffective assistance of counsel, and I think that the only inference you can draw from this is that he wouldn't have done it had he known what the consequences were, because here he's trying to vacate the consequences that he was misled into misled into having for
himself.
That
would seem to establish prejudice in every case in which a defendant is arguing for the right to withdraw a plea based upon ineffective assistance of counsel, that you could always say, well, the fact that you're trying to withdraw your plea now shows that you would have, you would not have pleaded guilty but for the ineffectiveness.
That's true, except we have some additional very specific facts that address the Padilla issue, and that he's not just simply trying to withdraw it, he's consulting an immigration lawyer to remedy the precise defect he alleged in ineffective assistance of counsel that led to the immigration consequence. So the facts here are very specific. He's not just going to a lawyer, he's going to an immigration lawyer who has now advised his district court lawyer about how to remedy the mess that the lawyer got him into by not advising him properly. I don't think there's any other way to read that, because this is about a very specific immigration consequence here.
That's really, it seems like that, I had it up here. It seems like that was a discussion of what to do to remedy Mr. Boateng's situation, or the situation in which he finds himself. I didn't see in Mr. Boateng's own testimony any statement nor any affidavit from him that, had I known what I know now, I would not have pleaded guilty.
And the court's correct. That statement's not there.
But that's a simple enough, if that's the fact, that's a simple enough matter to prove, and it wasn't proved.
It would have been a simple enough matter to do it just like this. That wasn't done. What we have is the record here, and I'm suggesting is that there is no other way to rationally account for why he's going to an immigration lawyer after the fact to remedy precisely what his lawyer should have advised him of at the time. That there's no other way to meaningfully read that than a person trying after the fact to remedy on his own the problems he faced with his the ineffective assistance of counsel. It's not that straightforward of a statement like the court said. He doesn't say, yeah, I wouldn't have pled guilty. But of course, even if he had, the judge or the court doesn't have to believe him.
Right. I'm just trying to figure out how we infer what could easily have been said when it wasn't said.
Wasn't said, and I think I've provided my theory about how the court can infer it. Thank you.
Thank you, and thank you to both counsel for your written submissions and your oral argument. Especially thank you for being prepared to address the issue that we raised. Didn't give you a lot of time, but I'll just say that the oral representation, oral argument on that issue by both counsel was exceptional today, especially given the short notice. But even without the short notice, thank you very much for your argument. Maybe you should have caught it before, but that's okay. Sometimes we miss things, but well done. Thank you. Both of your clients are very well represented today. The matter is submitted, and we will issue our opinion within the statutory period. Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.